Shrink Wrap Radio number 713. Retired UC professor Carl Jorgensen reflects on race in America.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
Before we get started, I have a special announcement. One of my listeners let me know that August 22nd, 2020, was the 15th anniversary of Shrink Wrap Radio. I must admit, I lost track. August 22nd has already come and gone, but I'm planning an anniversary show for the week of September 21. And here's where you come in. I would love it if you would send brief congratulatory emails to me at shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com with happy birthday in the subject line. I'll read these out loud on that birthday show. Even better would be brief audio congratulations, which you can leave on my Google Voice number, which is in the U.S. at 1-415-830-4014, or you can send a recorded voice file as an attachment to my email address. Now, make sure you don't go on and on. They should be relatively brief. But do it now, because September 21st will be here before we know it, and it will add much to the celebration. Thanks. My guest today is Carl Jorgensen, Ph.D., a friend from grad school at the University of Michigan. He's a professor emeritus at the University of California at Davis, where he taught for 35 years, chairing the African American Studies Curriculum Committee for almost all of that time. He did his undergraduate work at Harvard and his doctoral work at the University of Michigan, where he was the only African American in his program. For more information about Carl Jorgensen, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Carl Jorgensen, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, it's good to be talking to you again after 50 years, David.
Oh, my goodness. You've just given us, you've just blown our cover. I know. Isn't that amazing to think of?
Yeah, it is.
Just to bring the audience in on this, you and I knew each other as graduate psychology students. I was going to say many years ago, but now we'll say 50 years ago at the University of Michigan. And now we're going to be talking about race. People advocating racial reconciliation say that whites need to be proactive in communicating with blacks. Mm-hmm. And so I realized I was, when that thing first started to be so live as it is now, I thought of, well, you know, who could I reach out to and talk to? And I remembered you.
Yeah.
And I thought, I'd really like to reach out to Carl and, you know, and see what his take is on all of this. And I realized that you and I had not had personal conversations of that sort. And right. So I'm glad that we're going to have this opportunity to do that. So I'm reaching out to you as a white man to a black friend to ask you about your life as a black man that I neglected to ask you about back at
University of Michigan.
Yeah. And we were both, you know, very involved in what we were involved in. So it's not like you were, I doubt that you were missing that conversation from me. And I want to acknowledge that, you know, a lot of the talk about black men, it's a sort of generalized conversation as if all black men were the same, which is not the case at all. And yeah, you're a very specific black man with a very specific high achieving career, and so we just want to say that at the front. So we're going to start off very personally, if you don't mind, about your personal history, and then we'll get into some of the larger issues of the day. Hopefully, there'll still be time to do that. Yeah. So, is that okay as a program?
It's wonderful. I mean, I want to say that you're asking me questions about myself personally and how that related to my theories about race was very useful. And how I want to begin is to say that I came from a family and a community that I think very, very few, hardly any whites had any idea existed. I was born in 1941 in Washington, D.C. And Washington, D.C. was a city where a lot of black people could get government jobs at that time, or at least at the time when I was socially conscious, let's say 1950. So you had this black middle class community there, which was a very positive black community. What happened with me in terms of getting to Harvard was when I was in my junior year of high school, there was a family gathering, and I met a first cousin of my grandmother who had been to Harvard. And after talking to me for an hour, he said, he told me he'd been to Harvard and he thought I should apply. I had never imagined applying to Harvard. I'd been thinking, maybe I'll apply to Amherst or Dartmouth.
Uh-huh.
You know, and seeing that as a daring thing to do. It turns out this man was a city councilman in New York City. He had written the first, at least I'm told, he had written the first fair housing bill passed in the country. He was a writer and also an editor for Life magazine, photographer as well. Also, it sometimes was an editor for Time. And then decades later, I discovered that his series on race, the race riots, had been voted by some group of newspaper people, one of the top 100 stories of the 20th century.
Wow.
So I applied to Harvard. He introduced me to Brooks Brothers, you know, the elite New England clothiers, and bought me a suit.
I always felt intimidated to walk into those stores, you know, those clothing stores like that, where it was like very kind of hoity-toity, you know?
Well, he was like a city councilman.
Yeah.
And the people in New York knew him. And when he took us out to eat at a fancy restaurant, you know, the waiters came right up to him by name and spoke to him, you know, like personally.
Wow.
He was a big deal politically in New York City. But what I wanted to talk about was, so I went to Harvard 62, and, you know, my GRE and SAT scores were up there with the average Harvard undergraduate, maybe higher in math. Well, they must have been higher in math than the average Harvard undergraduate. So I was Harvard 62. My best friend and one of my first cousins was Harvard 63. A second cousin was Harvard 64.
Wow.
My sister was admitted to Radcliffe for 65, but went to Wellesley.
Wow. Wow. And, were in a very high achieving family. You've leaped way ahead. I was going to ask you more questions about your childhood.
Go ahead. Let me finish this and then go back to my childhood.
Okay.
The point being that I had this background that is, in this community, which you said was really just so prepared for the opportunities that opened up in the late 1950s, that I think white people weren't aware of then and probably aren't aware of now.
Yeah, you know, that makes a really good point because, as I was saying before, there's a sort of stereotypical image of what a black man is, but in fact, there have been high-achieving blacks going all the way back. That the white community has been mostly very unaware of. And so it almost is shocking sometimes to whites, I think, to discover. And I suppose this is some kind of discussion of class has to come in here, of social economic class, that accounts for those vast, you know, there's much differences in social economic standing in the black community as there probably is in the white community.
Well, at this time, and I know I'll get back to my early family if you want, but let me tell you, Sidge, my mother and maternal grandmother and uncle worked in the family-owned printing shop. It was the largest black printing shop east of California.
Wow.
Had about 10, maybe 12 employees, and lasted until, I think, the 1980s. Yes, I was middle class economically, but had a much higher status in the black community socially, because my great grandfather, actually my great grandfather was one of the people who helped start the Niagara Movement. So I have
don't know what that is. I don't know what the Niagara Movement is.
That was when black people got together to organize for reform. It was mostly black men, and it led to the NAACP, and Du Bois was sort of ahead of the Niagara Movement.
Okay.
And the NAACP grew out of that. And so a great-grandfather had bought some land from a black farmer off the Chesapeake Bay near Annapolis. And not my great-grandfather, I'm sorry. Frederick Douglass's son had bought this land. And in the Smithsonian says it was the first black recreational beach community in the United States.
Oh.
And I spent my summers there. It's like summer was slow time, and like my mother would be there Monday and Tuesday, my aunt Wednesday, my grandmother Thursday and Friday, and the whole family would come down Saturday and Sunday. So I spent my summers until I started working in the summer of my junior year or senior year down at this beach community, which was like 3 blocks by 4 blocks, where everyone knew each other and all the adults were watching us.
Yeah.
And we were like 2 miles over a bumpy dirt road from the highway. So we were an isolated beach community. And it was just wonderful because everyone there was supporting me intellectually.
Yeah, sounds like a really rich early experience. You know, my wife and I really enjoyed the series by Henry Gates, is it? Henry Gates, a Princeton professor, black professor, and a wonderful series about people's roots and genealogy and so on. So I'm wondering if, were you at all interested in that? How far back have you been able to trace your heritage? Because one of the points that he made was that some people, some black people, could only get up to, you know, it stopped at slavery. Other people black people started out as freemen in the early states, and so they could go way back. What's your family situation in terms of knowledge of your past?
Well, I did look this up recently. First, I'd say I'm about somewhere between 40 and 50% African.
Uh-huh. Did you send your genes to one of these services, 23andMe?
Yes.
Or, yeah, I did too.
Yeah. Well, no, that was my guess. Yes, I did send it in to Ancestry.com.
That's one we used.
But I forget, there's some, well, my great-grandfather on the father's side was Danish. And he had a child by a woman in West Indies. Then he went back home.
Okay.
So that we know. Let's see. There's, you know, we get into British and Irish ancestry on the Mary side. In fact, I'll tell you a funny story. One of my cousins, whose last name is Mary, went to Ireland. And a woman came up and hugged him and said, "Cousin." And he said, "Well, why are you calling me cousin? You don't know me." And she said, "There are only two Mary clans in Ireland, and they're all related." So that was funny. And on my father's side, the relatives were very fair on my father's side. And one of my relatives' first cousins on the airplane met a man, and I don't know whether it was named Monty Air or they were talking, and they found out that they, white man and he, shared this common ancestry through the Monty Airs. And the Monty Airs were a family where far back, one of them, there was a black woman who married a white man who was, I think, mayor of some northern city. And there's this, was this museum exhibition on Monty Airs as a family. So all of it is to say that, as you said, I had this background on the Mary side, my mother's side. It was a man who showed up in Alexandria, and he looked white, but he said he was black. And he was accepted into the Alexandria, Virginia, which is near Washington, D.C. community. And so that's sort of what it was.
Yeah, it's interesting that that if a person has any trace of black blood almost, that they are considered black, often from without, right?
That used to be true.
Not so much now?
No, I don't think so. Because you see now white people acknowledging that they've had black ancestry, but I don't think people treat them that different. I have a first cousin. My first cousin went to Harvard. I said it was very fair. And he used to, I found out recently, when he met other students at Harvard, he used to shake their hands and says, "I'm blank, blank, you know, and I'm Negro." But I don't think people care anymore if you're like 5 or 10% African.
Probably depends upon where that community is. But
it, maybe it depends upon where that community is. But
yeah,
to a fair degree, I think that has become unimportant.
Well, that's great. Maybe it's not great. It's, yeah. When I say it's great that there are people who there are two things going on here, I think, in what you're saying. Some people are really proud to claim African-American heritage, even if it's only small amounts, and that's a big change.
Yeah, to a large extent, it's a, for a lot of people, it's a question of what is your political identification? What is your cultural practice? And this is something I talk about when I teach, that it's not about genetics. You know, it's about cultural practice, political identification.
Well, we had a, I'm content to just go all over the place, which it feels like we're doing.
Yeah.
We had a guy, or I just reminded you that you had a long academic career at University of California, Davis.
Yeah.
I'm just kind of down the road, maybe 50 miles.
Yes.
Sonoma State University, where I also had a long academic career. Well, we had a guy come in who said he was black.
Yeah.
And was hired on the faculty in the psychology department, and was being very, very militantly black. You know, kind of doing a lot right. of what's called Mau-Mauing, you know, the white faculty yeah. there. And then it emerged at some point that his sister mm-hmm. came to us and told us that he was Jewish, that he wasn't black at all. So it's an example of what you're saying is that this guy, he grew up in an African-American neighborhood where a lot of his friends were, and that's really how he considered himself and how he wanted to be seen. It's a huge controversy in the university with some black people tremendously inflamed that he was misrepresenting himself as black. Other African-American faculty who mm-hmm. who were more understanding, whites who didn't know which way to go.
Right.
I mean, this could have been a major magazine story, I realize. It could have been in, you know, one of the major magazines, but nobody ever squealed to the outside world. But that could have been just a huge thing. But we didn't need that.
Let me tell you about, as I say, to me, it's complicated. I mean, one question is your status. How were you treated? Like my first cousin who's white, whose appearance is very white, and who was high up in a white business organization, national organization, one of their major lawyers. I don't think he got any flack from people because part of his ancestry was black, or got any flack from people by the fact that his aunt and uncle looked Negro, you know, I don't think people cared. But I have to ask him. I have to ask him about that. But that was my sense of it.
Yeah.
You know, it's really very. I'm sorry. It kind of moves me a little bit.
You and I haven't had a chance to talk about my background, but yeah. I have talked about it here on the show. I grew up in a mixed race family where my mother married an African American man. When I was just a baby, so he was the only dad that I ever grew up with. And I have a sister who, he's her father, you know, my white mother, you know, so she's kind of half and half, I guess. And
so you have a multi-racial sister.
Yeah, and also have another half-sister who's Jewish. I could have more easily coped with discovering that I was half black because when I was a little kid, the other black kids in the neighborhood would say, "Hey man, what are you?" And I'd say, "I'm half white milk, half chocolate milk." So I kind of assumed, you know, that he was my father. So it wasn't until later that I began to be able to distinguish that I wasn't. There were people in the black side of the family who passed as white. My dad had brothers who were very light skin, and they passed as white in some situations. And in the family we knew they were black, and they weren't rejected. I could imagine some situations black people would reject people who passed for white, be angry at them for.
I think whether they maintained a cultural and political identification, at least in the black middle class community I grew up in, I think that would be the critical issue.
Uh-huh.
You know, where did you stand politically? Where did you stand culturally? I have another story to tell you about that. So I heard that one of my father's half sisters had passed and had been an actress on Broadway. And so I looked her name up. I think it was Ingrid Jorgensen. And sure enough, there was an article in the New York Times, a mention of her as a dancer in some Broadway performance. But we never had contact with, you know, any of her descendants. So it was sort of like, well, what did that matter to me? But as I said, there were plenty of people on my father's side who could have passed for white if they wanted to, or who had to announce themselves as black. Otherwise, people would not realize they had an identification with the black community. But a lot of people are not aware of sort of the permeability of these ideas. There was the daughter of a congressman here, he may have just been a state senator or assemblyman at that time, who belonged to a black sorority here. When I was teaching interracial interpersonal dynamics, one year I stopped the class and pointed out there's a white guy who was on the football team, was really friends with the black students and very close to them. And I called him John. I said, does anyone here realize that John just refers sometimes three times to we black men and nobody said anything? You know,
yeah, as far as
so he was so accepted into the black community that he could talk about we black men, and none of the black students in the class murmured a word about, or no one seemed to even notice it.
Yeah, you know, in Los Angeles where I grew up, there's a, and I'm blocking on his name, you would know it probably because he became he moved up into the Berkeley area and had a radio show, but he was a disc jockey, a DJ, and you know, and he talked black, and he, you know.
Is that Johnny Otis?
Yeah, Johnny. Yeah, that's Johnny Otis. I grew up listening to Johnny Otis on the radio. Yeah.
So did I. Well, no, I listened to his songs.
And he's Greek.
Yeah, it was Johnny Otis and the Charms, and there's his song, That's Your Mistake, to Think I Was a Fool. You know, that's your mistake to break this lover's rule.
I remember Hand Jive. That's the only one by him.
Yeah, that's the other one, but another one. Yeah, no, I listen to his radio show sometimes.
Yeah.
But there was that.
But that's an example of somebody who was not black, but who was so drawn to black musical culture that he really totally moved into it.
Oh, this is sort of funny. We have some more commonalities. My uncle was Jewish, white Jewish.
Okay.
One of my father's sisters married a Jewish man. And he told me, you know, that because he had a house down at Highland Beach, this black beach community. And he told me that he never would have had the opportunity to meet the accomplished people he met in the black community, you know, just as a regular white person, that it was, you know, sort of for him, this introduction to this community he didn't know. And he gave me a book, copy of a book, an Encyclopedia of Jewish Humor, which I really loved. I can't find it now. Yeah, that was kind of amazing. Now, another thing about my family is when I went to Harvard, my grandmother took me aside and said, if something happened to my parents, she'd see that I got through Harvard. But my Uncle Benny also took me aside and said the same thing. You know, so I had these two other people in the family who said, if your parents die, we'll see that you get through Harvard.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Well, one of the things that I, you know, we can skip over a lot of the childhood stuff because we're kind of getting it in the in between here. But have you ever experienced racial discrimination? Have you felt discriminated against anywhere in your career?
Well, yes, but in two sort of ways. One is, when I was in high school, I applied for a summer job with a mathematician at a nearby college, and he didn't accept me. And I was like, you know, I'm qualified for this. But maybe I wasn't. I don't know. But when I came to, well, I grew up in a segregated town. I mean, so when I was, we were down at the beach, my white cousins would get in the car and drive to the drive-in where blacks weren't allowed, and then have me sit in the back seat and hide myself.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah.
You know, yeah. So there's that. And all of the places around the beach were segregated. Annapolis was segregated. As teenagers, we were told, don't go into Annapolis unless you have to because the police are mean there.
Because what?
The police were mean there.
Yeah, yeah. So I wanted to ask you if you, what messages you received growing up about being black and about where you could and could not go or should and should not go and in relation to law enforcement.
Well, there was legal segregation in D.C. when I was growing up.
Which means, are you talking about labeled drinking fountains and bathrooms or
no,
what?
I'm talking about you couldn't. I really don't remember, you know, because some of this had ended by the time I became, let's say, 12
uh-huh.
or 14. And so I know there was segregation, but I don't, like, in Annapolis there was a lot of segregation, but I don't know, don't remember exactly how it worked, whether it was just, there were places you just were not going to go into, or, but I remember there was a grocery store near Highland Beach, and where black people also shopped, and at the time that seemed kind of interestingly special, you know, different to me. Well, the schools were segregated until 1954. I mean, I went to all black schools. Until high school.
I went to an all-black school for a while in L.A. but it wasn't because, I mean, it was just people chose, well, partly was choice, partly was enforced probably by redlining and things like that. Yeah. But there were neighborhoods, you know, would be racially divided.
Right.
And
well, here's another aspect of it. So I had a close Jewish friend and a close, well, acquaintance. We were very friendly Chinese boy in high school, but we never associated outside of the high school. I went to Harvard where I had white roommates, but we never associated outside of Harvard, even though all three of us lived in D.C. It wasn't until I came back from the Peace Corps. Excuse me, let me turn around because I have to do something with my nose here. So I was in the Peace Corps in Nepal, 62 to 64, and it was there I felt fully accepted by the white volunteers. And when I came back, I was wondering, well, how are we going to be when we get back? And we were all friends. You know, that was my first group of, you know, white friends whom I saw, whom I would go visit their homes.
Yeah, you were how old then?
I would have been 23.
Okay, okay.
23, and I would have been 1964. Race had so changed between 62 when I entered the Peace Corps and 64 when I came back. And I'm not sure whether it's because Ann Arbor was a different place than Harvard, Cambridge, or was that it was a different age group, like, you know, 23-year-olds or don't care what their parents think that much.
Yeah.
You know, they're independent rather than dependent or counter-dependent more or what. But it was really much more social association.
So it became
graduate school.
Race was not an issue in Ann Arbor when you were.
Well, it was.
I mean, it was an issue there. There weren't a lot of blacks though in Ann Arbor, but there was a black neighborhood, and there were some.
Yeah, well, there was this Greek lunch counter I used to go to, until a white friend of mine told me that he hadn't hired a black woman because he was afraid of how his customers would respond. And I stopped going there. I really should have gone there and talked to him about it.
Say that again. I think I missed some key part.
There was a Greek lunch counter.
Yeah.
In Ann Arbor. Run by a Greek man. It wasn't Greek. It was regular, but the owner was Greek. And a white friend of mine told me that she had recommended a black woman to work there, and he had decided he couldn't hire her because of how customers would react to it.
Uh-huh.
So,
there was a town and gown issue there in Ann Arbor where the townies, as in many university neighborhoods, were very different than the students.
Yeah.
And much more likely to have racism ingrained.
Yeah. But the other racial issue, and this is part of what I wanted to talk about, is that it was very difficult psychologically to deal with the fact that there were two types of explanations of why blacks were low status and low income and low education in academia at that time. One was that blacks were on average less intelligent than whites, and that turned out to be a bunch of nonsense research, which really any unbiased second year psych student could have recognized was crap if they'd really looked at it openly. Yeah. And the second was that black culture had been destroyed by slavery. And neither one of those was true, but I was in a culture where those were prevalent beliefs, and particularly the IQ stuff. There was Jensen at Harvard, and I just forget his name, the most eminent psychologist in England, were also these people who pushed this IQ stuff. And to just say one thing, Jensen, I don't know whether it was Jensen or the other man, who published publications about the IQ of supposedly IQ and genetics, IQ among identical twins. And there was this correlation. And let's say there was one sample size, it was like 23. And then there was a sample size, of, let's say it was 27. Uh-huh. Then there was a sample size that was, say, it was 33. And the reported correlation as being the same to three decimal places. It's like anybody who knows anything about statistics knows that's impossible.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it doesn't make any logical sense. So there I was with people believing in this stuff, and I'm a graduate student, and it's like, I'm like, this is total crap.
You know?
And you know, but as a black person, I can't say this is total crap because I don't know how to prove it's total crap.
Yeah. Well, sent something to me. We had a bit of correspondence before this interview, and you'd made reference to the fact that you kind of struggled with that as a graduate student because you were trained in the canons of science and believed in science as a valid path to knowledge. Yeah. And yet you were getting this stuff that just so conflicted with what you intuitively knew.
Yes.
And so, interestingly, just last night, I was listening to Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Yes, right.
He's
wonderful.
Yeah, he's a wonderful astrophysicist. And I was watching a masterclass, masterclass.com, that he was talking about. And he was talking about scientific thinking and the kinds of bias that can get in the way of scientific thinking. And one of the things that he talked about was cultural bias and how unconsciously people of goodwill and high intelligence can be biased in ways that they're unaware of.
Well, let me tell you about something else that bothered me about psychology in the 1960s and 1970s. Now, when I went to UC Davis, about half the psychologists there believed this stuff, that blacks were on average less intelligent than whites. And I was contrary to that, and I wrote a paper where I reviewed Kamen's The Science and Politics of IQ, and I reviewed it by checking all of his references and checking all of the references of Arthur Jensen and this British psychologist and talking about where there was bias and where there was not bias. And I gave a talk on that in psychology, and a faculty said they found my talk very confusing.
They said what?
But they found my talk very confusing. Huh. And I was like, this is not confusing. What the hell's going on there? And then there was this white female who was also in graduate school at the time. I'll give her a name. She was a wonderful woman, Yvonne Clearwater. And she told me later that she had done the same thing, talk about bias and racial IQ, and everyone was telling her she was confusing. They couldn't understand what she was talking about. Uh-huh. But let me tell you one thing that bothered me about the psychologist, not as a scientist, but as a mathematician, because my BA was in math from Harvard. It was like, okay, people would say, well, IQ is what IQ tests measure. And then at the end of the paper, when they were talking about the results with respect to IQ, they would make comments about common definitions or meanings of intelligence. And they hadn't established a relationship between those things.
Yeah.
You know, they hadn't established a relationship between objective measure IQ and a social conception of intelligence. And I remember the same thing happening with someone doing an objective definition of love. And at the end of the paper, they're talking about love in a colloquial sense. And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, this is just, I will use a minor word, this is just damn stupid.
Yeah,
These people are idiots. And so they're calling themselves scientists, but scientifically they're idiots, at least with respect to this one dimension. They were brilliant on other dimensions.
Well, fortunately, in the field of psychology, I mean, we have evolved. The field has evolved to the place that has begun to recognize all sorts of bias. And
I was going to add to that I have no idea what's going on in psychology now, and no one should take what I said.
Because you sort of
anything about what psychology has been in the last 30 years.
Well, I've been blessed by the fact that I've been interviewing people in the field of psychology for, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds across the broad swath. Yeah. And so that's kind of kept me current in some ways about what's going on in psychology and psychotherapy that I would not have been had I not been doing this long.
Well, let me add something to it. There was, Dick Mann was one of my major professors at Harvard and at Michigan. And with Dick Mann, if something happened, I would talk to him the next day. He would say, this is what black people are going to think about this. And he was always right. So Dick Mann, I thought, well, here's a white man who can think black.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know how he achieved that. I don't know. I also had very positive contact with him. And he was... he got into one of the spiritual things, follower of Muktananda. And so I would posit the hypothesis that there was something deeply spiritual in him that, to where he could transcend those kinds of prejudices.
Oh, very much so. Though I have to tell you something else. I was in this class on interpersonal dynamics with him at Harvard. And part of what I did in this class was I was riding a high horse about race and class and gender. And in particular, in this class, we were reading case studies. I was like always saying, you can't judge women negatively for sexual activity that you judge males positively for, you know. And 20 years later, Dick told me that he had learned a lot from me.
That's good.
I changed his mind about some things. Yeah. He never knew what, I'd never heard what I changed his mind about. Uh-huh. But I mean, you're talking about how did it feel to be black? It was like, I was always fighting these battles about race and gender. When I was at Harvard, there would be, different people had different ways of establishing their blackness. My best friend who went to Harvard was always dressed to the T professionally. You know, suit, tie, perfect. What I would do, one of the things I would do would be if something said something that I thought was racist, I would try to trap them intellectually until they looked like a fool. You know, and so I was always sort of ready in some ways. If I heard something racist, to say, how can I make this person look like an idiot?
Uh-huh.
And then later I realized that, hey, when I was in trained Peace Corps training, that I was very good at making people look like idiots, but that was like being a bully.
Yeah, yeah.
And I really shouldn't be a bully. And to give that up.
Yeah, you know, good insight.
The fact that I could make someone look bad didn't mean that I was smarter or wiser than them, you know. It just meant I was a better fighter than they were.
I'm aware that
was another reaction to being black.
I'm aware that we've got about 10 more minutes, and I want to, you know, there's this whole uprising now, Black Lives Matter, social justice, et cetera. And so what has that, what's been the impact of that whole thing on you psychologically, emotionally, et cetera? And you're somebody, by the way, we should mention at least in passing, that you marched in Selma with Martin Luther King and other leaders from SNCC and so on. So you've got some history as an activist.
Well, no, I did not march in Selma, but anyhow.
Oh, you marched somewhere, didn't you? Didn't you tell me that?
Well, I was in Ann Arbor marching with police standing up on rooftops of
me too. Me too. I was in that same one for welfare mothers.
Yeah, I forget what it was for, but
yeah.
Okay. Those people have live ammunition up there.
I was shocked, you know. It's like, yeah, it's like.
Well, okay. You got to give this some context. Do you know that after the Civil War, there were large numbers of white females who came down south to help educate black people?
No.
There were. And, of course, the same thing happened in the civil rights movement. So what I'm saying is that more than once you have had white youth move to be really supportive of black people, and some positive things happened. But then there was also this situation where it died out. But there were things that also had changed forever. So this immersion of white people, a number of white people, into supporting black people is a repetition of something that happened before.
Yeah.
It was like all of a sudden in the 60s, the white churches and synagogue, I mean, Protestant, Catholic, Jewish, you know, all of a sudden announced themselves as anti-racist. I don't know whether they were converted or just decided to become vocal or both. So I see this as a positive event. I don't know where it ends. I think, and I am not often apocalyptic, but that if Trump is reelected, it's an absolute disaster for civil rights and for democracy. I mean, he keeps refusing to allow people to testify to Congress. He breaks laws, and like when he was, you know, earlier, he said, I can grab women well, I say, women buy their pussy, nobody will do anything to me about it. Well, that's a crime. And he was never arrested for that. And he's, all of his life, he's been involved in things that for other people looks like they're things that he did that would otherwise be criminal, and he gets away with it.
Yeah.
And it's like the Republican Party lets him get away with soliciting favors from other countries in return for the possibility of his getting something that supports him politically. And if he gets reelected, he's just going to go much more intensively into that. I mean, he will have learned again that doing things like having federal employees work to help support his reelection is against the law, but since no one in the executive branch is going to prosecute anybody for that, I don't care.
Yeah,
he will be doing more of that. And so I think this is a real deciding point.
Yeah, we're at a pivotal moment. Where the social consciousness, a broader awareness of what blacks have known for a long time is the problem with being black and relationships with law, with the police.
Yeah. I want to push two books that I think white people or everyone should read. One is The New Jim Crow, and the other is Slavery by Another Name.
Uh-huh.
And what the situation is that after slavery ended, there was tenant farming where people, blacks were working on farms and they had to pay money, but how much they owed was calculated by the white owners, and so they were always in debt forever and not being able to accrue wealth.
Right.
And then there was convict leasing where after the end of slavery, whites in the South were arresting blacks for no good reason. And then they would sell their labor out to companies. And this continued until the early 1900s. And then if you add on to that discriminatory law enforcement, you have the situation where there have been shadows of slavery impinging upon the black community until very recently. And now there are a number of books that have come out that are attacking that. And I think this is very important. But, you know, there's this part of the white community that's entirely resistant to acknowledging that this is taking place.
Yeah.
I don't know what's going to happen with this election. I think that Biden's going to win, but I'm not certain of it. But I think both Trump and Democrats are going to have things up their sleeve that they're going to try to pull. And I hope there's no more violence in cities, because I had written on Facebook in a couple of months early that Trump was just doing things for politically stupid. But it's not politically stupid for him to go around and saying, I'm going to be a law and order president.
Right. He knows how to play to his crowd. And what's been exposed is actually, you know, how divided we are. There are an awful lot of Americans who are not racist, and a dawning awareness of the role of privilege of that I think whites are slower to grasp the way that it's been built in, and so there's a bias that's built into our society and so on, that where it's not terribly visible.
Well, I want to give you a short version of something that I teach without going too far into it. If you go into science, there are points at which your ability to measure ends. There are things that are too small to measure, things that are too large to measure. Here's the thing. You cannot never completely understand the experience of another individual And you cannot ever become completely clear. I mean, the story of Buddha, part of the idea of Buddha is that you as an individual can never see the world as clearly as he did. Part of the message of Christianity is that God is all-knowing, but you're not. And it's like we can never call ourselves completely free of racism when we're living in a situation where there's a history that's been distorted by racism. For example, just for this, I started making a list of what were the black communities, business towns and business communities, residential business communities that had been partially or fairly completely destroyed by white riots. I'm up to 14, you know, whom I've searched and found on the web in like a day, but I don't find any list on the web of all of these places that have been destroyed by riots.
Yes.
Well, if you don't know that, then to some degree you've been influenced by racism whether you want to or not. And if you don't know that in some Native American tribes women made the decision about whether or not to go to war, then your knowledge of Native Americans has been influenced by racism. You know, so that no one can claim that they're free of influence from racism because no one can claim that they know everything.
Okay.
The question becomes, do you know enough for the situation at hand? And that's another issue.
Yeah. Well, we're kind of at the place where, just time-wise, I typically wrap things up here. Yeah. This is a conversation that you and I may continue to have, and that would be great. I would like to catch up with you more in terms of our experience, you know, the experiences that we've both had in life. And Dr. Carl Jorgensen, the very accomplished Dr. Carl Jorgensen, I really want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio. It was really great to reconnect with Carl Jorgensen, a friend from graduate school days. Actually, we didn't know each other that well back then, largely because we were never in the same classes. For me, one big learning from this interview is to be reminded once again that each person is a unique individual. Race is not a terribly good tag because it tends to evoke very strong stereotypes, which can be totally misleading when compared to any actual person. I had prepared questions on the assumption that Carl would have lots of childhood stories of deprivation, discrimination, and even danger. In fact, that stereotypical background didn't fit him at all, and I quickly realized that would be a fruitless line of questioning. Carl grew up in a rather extraordinarily accomplished middle-class family in the nation's capital. Not only did he attend Harvard as an undergraduate, but also had a number of his relatives in the extended family who had been students there. His extended family included wealthy individuals, successful business people, political stars, and more. If Carl was disadvantaged by the color of his skin, I'd conclude not very much. His main gripe in graduate school and since is that academic colleagues who should know better continue to buy into the notion that whites have superior IQs compared to blacks. They just haven't kept up with the research and can be maddeningly resistant to updating their views. I think Carl sees himself as the beneficiary of gains made in civil rights over the years. Of course, he's shocked and angered by the police brutality that's been brought to light. And of course, fearful of the gains that have been made in the past getting lost in the melee. I know him to be an activist on Facebook, where he frequently posts very articulate arguments against the injustices of the day. And I also know that a lot of his energy these days is devoted to the nurture and education of his young granddaughter. I look forward to continuing conversations with him and deepening our relationship.
Hello, fellow shrinkwrappers. I have a couple of questions for you. Do you think that Dave is doing a good job? Well, I do anyway. And do you wish for him to continue producing these podcasts? I sure do. So, are you willing to support him? I just did. It's easy. Go to the Shrink Wrap Radio website. Click Support on the top menu. Select the amount you wish to contribute. If you have a PayPal account, enter your credentials. If you don't have a PayPal account, you can still do one-time donations by just entering your credit card details. PayPal will take care of the rest, David will be happy, and we will all get the benefit of his excellent guests and his well-honed interview skills. Now to my last question. When will you do it?
Thank you, Sven in Sweden, for your tribute and financial contributions. And as I've said before, to those of you listening today, I only want you to consider donating if you can comfortably do so. At the same time, I'm very grateful to all of our regular donors out there. You know who you are, and your continuing support means so much to me. So with that, we'll wrap it up once again. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Carl Jorgensen, old friend and professor emeritus at the University of California, Davis, for sharing about his own life experiences as a high-achieving African-American and his commentary on race at this time in America. Next week, I'll be speaking with return guest Stephen Post, Ph.D., about his latest book, God and Love, on Route 80. I interviewed Stephen back in 2007 on the psychology of doing good. I'm sure he'll have the same sort of uplifting message we need in these trying times. So please join us then. And until then, please be kind to yourself and others.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.